coming up on this week's mini episode of the Drew Perowit Podcast.
When you lose your fear of dying, you also lose your fear of living to the fullest, because you're not afraid of taking risks and losing something because you're not afraid of what comes next. And they say that once you have this near-death experience, you realize that you're not alone. You're part of something much greater than yourself, which means that the problems of this bag of skin are not all that important.
Hi, everyone. It's Drew. There's a reason I've talked to so many experts on my podcast about magnesium. This super mineral is needed for over 400 enzymatic reactions in your body. In fact, every single cell contains it and needs it to function. Magnesium is essential for stress management and restful sleep because of its influence on neurotransmitters. It supports insulin sensitivity and fights the risk of type 2 diabetes. And magnesium also reduces C-reactive protein and many other markers of inflammation, among so many other crucial functions. I personally started taking magnesium to help with my sleep, especially when I travel, which we're all starting to do again, and it's been a game changer. But I don't just take any old magnesium. I take Bio-Optimizer's Magnesium Breakthrough. It contains seven different forms of magnesium, which all have different functions in the body. I haven't found anything else like it on the market. That's why I hand it to all my friends like candy. Bio-Optimizer's is great because all their products are soy-free, gluten-free, lactose-free, non-GMO, free of chemicals and fillers, and made with all natural ingredients. Right now, Bio-Optimizers is offering my community a few special bundles. Just head over to magbreakthrough.com/Drew, spelled differently, D-H-R-U, with the code DREW10, D-H-R-U-10. So that's magbreakthrough, magbreakthrough.com/DHRU with the code DREW10. If you missed any of that, it's in the show notes. Community and relationships are everything to me. Great relationships start with solid, straightforward, and loving communication. One of the most game-changing experiences in my life to support better relationships is couples therapy. Even though a lot of people view couples therapy as a last resort intervention, I actually view it as an integral first step in creating a solid foundation for a super strong relationship. In fact, many experts actually consider better communication as integral to our health as nutrition, exercise, and sleep. Now, my fiance and I, soon to be wife, have been seeing a therapist since the start of our relationship, and I believe it's helped us thrive as a couple. In fact, I know it's helped us thrive as a couple. We found someone who was committed to helping us increase positive communication, mutual respect, intimacy, and providing us with tools to use in everyday life. I'm such an advocate of therapy and couples therapy, which is why I love BetterHelp. The past year has been so challenging for so many, and BetterHelp allows us to get affordable counseling anytime from anywhere in the world. They will actually match you with a licensed professional therapist based on your unique needs, and you can do all the sessions online from the comfort of your own home. It's super convenient and super powerful. You can actually start communicating with a counselor in under 48 hours, and then you can send them a message at any time to schedule weekly video or phone consultations. They have so many different specialties for whatever your needs are. But if you're in a relationship, just remember, and the data supports this, it's never too late or too early to start couples counseling. As a listener of my podcast, you can get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/Drew. That's better, BETTER, help, HELP.com/Drew. It's spelled funny, DHRU. Get the support and help you need. Check out BetterHelp today. Now back to today's episode. Hi, everyone. Drew Perowit here. We often think of the mind as a creation of the brain, or that the mind and the brain are one and the same. But when the brain is offline for a number of reasons, like illness or injury, the mind can sometimes still be very active. Cases of near-death experiences have been reported since the beginning of times. And almost 10% of people whose heart completely stops report a near-death experience, an out-of-body experience. The medical world has generally ignored these near-death experiences and dismissed them as tricks of the brain or wishful thinking. In today's mini episode, I speak with Dr. Bruce Grayson and Dr. Jim Tucker about some of the most dramatic accounts of near-death experiences and stories of reincarnation. They share how these experiences and their research around both these topics can reveal a lot about dying and what might come after life itself. Let's listen in, starting with Dr. Bruce Grayson, a professor of psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. He was the co-founder and president of the International Association of Near-Death Studies and the editor of the Journal of Near-Death Studies. His award-winning research has led him to become a Distinguished Life Fellow for the American Psychiatric Association and to be invited by the Dalai Lama himself to participate in dialogue between Western scientists and Buddhist monks in India. His book, After, is the culmination of almost a half a century of scientific research. Let's talk about some of the early experience, or specifically the early experience that you had that started to have you open up and maybe question some of what you know. So just setting the time and place for our audience, you were in your first few months of your internship.
Right, right.
Psychiatric medicine.
Right.
And I'd love to turn it over to you to talk about that time.
Well, you know, there I was, a green intern, not very sure of myself, trying to look more professional than I felt. And I got called one evening to go to the emergency room and evaluate a patient who had been admitted with an overdose. So I went down to see her, and she was completely unconscious as far as I could tell. I tried to speak with her. I moved her limbs around, and she had absolutely no response at all. So I assumed she was out cold based on whatever medication she had taken. However, her roommate had brought her into the hospital and was waiting down the hall in another room to talk to me. So I went down to the other room and got from the roommate information about the patient, what stressors she had been under, what she might have taken, and so forth. And then when I finished talking with the roommate, I went back to see the patient, and she was still apparently totally unconscious. So she was admitted to the intensive care unit overnight, and I arranged to see her the following morning after she awoke. When I went there the following morning, she was barely awake, very, very drowsy, but I could talk with her. So I introduced myself, and she said, "I know who you are. I remember you from last night." Well, that kind of surprised me because I didn't think she had any memory of me from last night. So I said to her, "I'm surprised. I thought you were unconscious when I came to see you." And then she said to me in a very clear tone, "Not in my room. I saw you talking to my roommate." Well, that kind of startled me because I couldn't imagine what she was talking about. So I said, "You know, do you mean the nurses told you I talked to your roommate?" And she said, "No." And then she opened her eyes, looked at me straight in the eye, and said, "I saw you." Well, that made no sense to me at all. The only way she could have done this is she had left her body and come with me down to the other room. And as far as I could tell, I was my body. How can you leave your body? So she could see my skepticism, and she then proceeded to tell me about my conversation with her roommate, everything we said, what we were wearing, where we were sitting, and she made no mistakes. It just blew me away. But I couldn't deal with my confusion. I was there to do a job, to help her with her confusion, to deal with her feelings of being suicidal and her future suicide risk. So I had to kind of push that out of my own feelings out of my mind for a while and try to deal with her. I didn't dare tell anyone else about this. They would think I was crazy. So I just kept it to myself. And as the days went on, I started thinking, nah, that couldn't have happened. I must have been mishearing her, or maybe she was playing a trick on me somehow. I couldn't imagine how, but I kind of assumed this couldn't really have happened. And yet it did. So I kind of tried not to think about it, not very successfully, for a few years. And then eventually, Raymond Moody joined me at the University of Virginia. And Moody, in 1975, had written a book called Life After Life, in which he gave us the term near-death experience and described what they are like. And that was my first inkling that this experience the patient told me about was not just one isolated event, but it's part of a much larger phenomenon that happened to a lot of people.
I think this is a perfect time to bring in one of the stories that is incredibly powerful. I mean, there's so many stories inside the book that you share. There's one story that really just builds on top of that early experience that you had. And it's in a story of, I don't remember exactly, but a gentleman who went in for surgery, who had a relationship with a nurse who was,
who
the red MGB. Can you tell us a little bit about this story?
Sure. You're right. I should say also that that first experience I had, I didn't know anything about near-death experiences at that time. So I didn't know to ask her about other features she might have had in her experience. And so there's a lot of information about her experience that I just don't have. So I tended not to pay a lot of attention to experiences like that. Now, the gentleman you're talking about, his name was Jack. I interviewed him probably 25 years later. And at that point, I knew a lot about what near-death experiences were like. He had his experience in the 1970s. He was at that time a 25-year-old technical writer who was hospitalized with severe pneumonia. And he had repeated episodes of respiratory arrest where he just could not breathe. And he had one particular nurse who got very close to him, who was a young, attractive nurse. He used to try to flirt with her. And at one point, she told him that she was going to be taking the long weekend off. And he said goodbye to her, wished her well. And shortly after she left, he had another respiratory arrest and had to be resuscitated. And at that point, he had a near-death experience. And he said that he found himself in a pastoral scene, and he was very peaceful, and he was kind of enjoying being there when he saw this nurse, Anita, come walking towards him. He was startled to see her there, so he said, "Anita, what are you doing here?" And she said, essentially, "This is where I am now, but you have to go back. And I want you to tell my parents that I love them, and I'm sorry I wrecked the red MGB." And then she turned and walked away. And then he later awoke in his hospital bed, having been resuscitated, with full memory of his near-death experience. And he told the first nurse he saw about the experience, and she immediately started crying and went out of the room. It turned out that this nurse had taken the weekend off to celebrate her 21st birthday with her parents, who had flown in from the country to celebrate with her. And they gave her, for her birthday, a red MGB. She was very excited, jumped in the car and took off down a hill, lost control of the car and smashed into a telephone pole, dying instantly. And this was a few hours before the patient's cardiac arrest, well, his respiratory arrest. And yet he knew that she was dead. There was no way he could have expected to have met her, because he had no way of knowing that she had died. And he certainly couldn't have known how she died. And yet he did, in great detail. We have just no explanation for how that could be.
Incredible story. And really what you've dedicated your life to is, you know, first, anybody who's listening to that story and me having read about it, it gives you chills, because there's a sensation that we don't know what is going on, but what we do know is, well, what we maybe know is that the world that's in front of us isn't our only experience.
Right,
there's something else that's happening. You said in the early days that you approached this as a scientist, and you would try to come up with hypotheses.
Yes.
To try to break down the different types of themes and experiences that were there. And one of the things that you were exploring is this idea that some of these near-death experiences that people went through seemed to show that there was, that the mind and the brain weren't always intertwined.
Can you chat
a little bit about more about that?
Sure. Well, let me define things first. The brain is this 3-pound mass of gray pink tissue inside your skull. And the mind is that part of you that thinks and perceives and feels and makes decisions and so forth. And we usually think that the mind is simply what the brain does, that all our thoughts and perceptions and memories are created by the brain, because that's the way it seems in everyday life. when you get drunk, you don't think very clearly. When you get hit on the head or have a stroke, that affects your thinking. So it seems in everyday life as if the brain does create the mind or is the mind. However, in certain circumstances, like the near-death experience, the brain seems to be getting diminished in its abilities. It may be totally offline, and yet our thinking and our perceiving are more vivid than ever. And this cannot be if the brain is actually creating the mind. I should say that the near-death experience is not the only example of this. There's something called terminal lucidity, in which people who have advanced dementia like Alzheimer's disease and haven't been able to communicate for years and don't recognize their family suddenly become completely lucid again in the hours or sometimes days before they die. And they carry on coherent conversations and recognize people again. And the family gets very excited thinking, oh, they're recovering. But of course, the brain cannot recover from something like that. And they end up dying shortly thereafter. And we have no medical explanation for how that can be. We also have some neuroimaging studies of people having psychedelic drug trips in the last decade that have shown something very interesting. We always assumed that the way psychedelic drugs worked was by stimulating the brain to produce hallucinations. And what these studies, which are done primarily in Johns Hopkins University in the US and Imperial College in London, have consistently shown that with a variety of psychedelic drugs, the more elaborate mystical-like experiences people have under these drugs are associated with a decrease in brain activity. So the brain activity goes down and then the consciousness goes up. And that just doesn't fit what we usually think of as the brain creating the mind. So it suggests that the mind is not part of the brain. Now, how do we explain that? It seems as if the mind is something else. And if it is something else, what is it and where is it? And I don't have an answer to that. But it raises all sorts of questions like, how does this non-material mind interact with the physical brain? And we don't have any answer to that. However, the materialistic explanation that the brain creates the mind also has equally large holes in it. And the most basic problem is, how does a physical, chemical, or electrical impulse in the brain create a non-physical thought or feeling or perception? And we have not the hint of the suggestion of the slightest idea of how to ask that question. We have just no idea how a brain process can create a thought. So it seems as if the mind and the brain are not the same thing. And this is not, by the way, a new idea. Hippocrates wrote about this 2,000 years ago. He said the brain is the messenger or the interpreter of the mind. And this has been a minority opinion throughout the last 2,000 years among scientists. And many use an analogy of a filter of some sort. An example is your cell phone. Your cell phone receives radio waves, and there are thousands and thousands and millions of radio waves out there. And if you try to listen to all of them at the same time, if your phone didn't filter them out, you wouldn't be able to understand any of them. So your cell phone filters out all the signals except the one frequency you want to listen to. And if it didn't do that, you wouldn't be able to understand anything. You'd be flooded with all this miscellaneous material. And in the same way, they say, the brain selects all the contents of your mind, all your consciousness, and filters out the irrelevant parts and just lets in the information that you need to survive in the physical world. The brain, after all, evolved in the physical world to help us survive in this realm. And it lets in that information that's important to surviving here, how to find shelter, food, a mate, and so forth. It doesn't need information about deceased loved ones or deities in order to survive in the physical world. This should not be surprising to scientists because all our senses are like this. There's lots of wavelengths out there that we don't see when we look. We just see a small portion of the visible spectrum that's relevant to our survival. And our ears filter out a lot of sound frequencies that we don't need and just lets in those few frequencies that are essential to our survival. So it makes sense that the brain may do the same thing with our thoughts.
On top of that, would it be also fair to say, and I know languaging is so important here, but would it be fair to say that it seems that if we use the term consciousness in terms of, you know, awareness, the perception of awareness that's there, that consciousness, based on these collection of near-death experiences, it seems that consciousness could be bigger than our immediate physical body. Would that be fair to say, or would you say that in a different way?
Well, that's what almost every near-death experiencer I've talked to has said, that once you are, quote, free of the brain, you're able to appreciate everything else that's going on around us. And that when you come back into the brain, you feel restricted again. They talk about trying to squeeze themselves back into this inadequate shell. And many of them say that there were things that happened in the near-death experience that were crystal clear to them. Their thinking was faster and clearer than ever. And when they come back to this realm, they have trouble understanding it because their brain limits their understanding. Let me give you a specific example of that. Most near-death experiencers say that in this other realm that they were in during the near-death experience, there was no sense of time. That time is just something that we impose on the physical realm. But in the other realm, there was no sense of time, that things happened at the same time and things happened in eternity. And there's just no concept of how long something took. It was all eternal. And yet when they tell me about what happened in the near-death experience, they describe it as a sequence of events. This happened, and then this happened, and this happened. So, you know, I say to them, how can you have a sequence of events if there isn't a time? Because events happen in time. And they just kind of shrug and say, I know that when I try to explain it to you in terms of this world, it's a paradox. It doesn't make sense. But in the other world, it made perfect sense.
Yeah, and when you know, I'm by no means trained in this area at all, but when you read as a layperson like myself about some of the elements and discoveries of quantum physics, you start to see that with different dimensions and coexisting states, there could be some truth to that. We don't know exactly how it works, but there does seem to be some validity for it.
Exactly. You know, the old Newtonian mechanics that we used for hundreds of years works very well for everyday life. But in the early 20th century, when we started exploring very, very fast speeds and very, very small objects, subatomic particles, the Newtonian mechanics we've been using for everyday life did not work anymore. And we needed to add to our sense of physics the ideas of relativity and quantum mechanics. In the same way, the idea that the brain creates the mind is a fine model for everyday life. But when you get to extreme situations, like when the brain is going offline, you need a new model. So I think just as we're finding that physics as we know it doesn't apply to all different circumstances, so too, the materialistic conception of brain and mind doesn't apply in all circumstances.
You know, philosopher and teacher who was early in the world of psychedelics and probably led to some of that backlash of psychedelics being banned and, you know, being called a class three drug is the spiritual teacher Ram Dass, who passed away a few years ago. And he had this great quote that I always remember. He said, you know, in the space of like awakening, there's this recognition of death is simply like taking off a tight shoe.
Yes.
And I thought about that quote when I was reading through your book, because one of the things that you highlighted from the folks who had gone through these near-death experiences is that, as you say, largely they were pleasant experiences and they were left with this feeling of a reduction of fear death.
Yes.
Can you share any more about that?
Yeah, that's probably the most common after effect of a near-death experience. No matter what people say this other realm is like, they report almost universally that it is not something that is unpleasant or something to be afraid of, that they welcome it. And that leads them to be no longer afraid of death or dying. Now, when I heard about that, as a psychiatrist, I immediately thought about, is this going to make people more suicidal? Because I deal with suicide all the time as a psychiatrist. So I did a study of that, you know, being a scientist. So I interviewed people who were admitted to my hospital with a suicide attempt and tried to look at those who had a near-death experience as a result of that attempt and those who didn't have a near-death experience. And I compared their suicidal thinking afterwards. And what I found was that those who had a near-death experience were much less suicidal than those who didn't have an NDE. And when I asked them to explain that to me, what they said was essentially that when you lose your fear of dying, you also lose your fear of living to the fullest, because you're not afraid of taking risks and losing something because you're not afraid of what comes next. And they say that once you have this near-death experience, you realize that you're not alone. You're part of something much greater than yourself, which means that the problems of this bag of skin are not all that important. There's a lot more going on. And you tend to see your problems not as something to be escaped from, but as something to struggle with and learn from and grow from. And that gives them a sense of meaning and purpose in their lives that they didn't have before.
As your book is approaching launching, you know, you've been getting fantastic press. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I hope this podcast can add to that. But there was an article that was published yesterday in the Daily Mail, you know, not typically a website that I read, but I'm always happy when people that I look up to are getting featured in there because I know they have a wide reach. And the title of the article, I'm just paraphrasing here, is that, a doctor writes a book about near-death experiences. And the bottom line is they make you a happier, sort of more whole person. And I think that when people, you know, pick up your book or are new to your work and they're reading it, there's the question of like, okay, I'm living. I haven't had a near-death experience right now. How can maybe I benefit from some of these findings that are there in my own life? If I want to get some of the things that these people have had, what can I do to benefit from that?
Yeah. Well, actually, the good news is that you don't have to have a near-death experience to have some of these same side effects. There have been six studies at this point of people who took classes in near-death experiences. Four of them were in college students who had a course in near-death experience. One was in nursing students, and one was actually in high school students who learned about near-death experiences. And in follow-up studies, they found that up to a year after the course, these people were more compassionate, more altruistic, more loving, more concerned about other people than they had been before. So some of this information that comes through a near-death experience can be transmitted without actually having the experience. And that, frankly, is one of the reasons I wrote my book after, hoping that people who read about this may share some of the same beneficial after effects as having a near-death experience.
And when you talk about these classes, for example, for those that are listening, are there resources or places out there that people can actually look up that you feel comfortable to mention?
Well, those classes were at colleges mostly, where you have to be enrolled in the college to take the class. But one of the best resources is the International Association for Near-Death Studies, and their website is www.iands.org. And they provide a lot of educational programs, a lot of accurate information about near-death experiences. They publish a newsletter, a journal. They have conferences and a lot of resources available to study about near-death experiences.
My next guest, Dr. Jim Tucker, is the director of the University of Virginia's Division of Perceptual Studies, where he's continuing the work of Ian Stevenson with children who report memories of detailed past lives. He is the author of Before, Children's Memories of Previous Lives, a new two-in-one edition of his books, Life Before Life and Return to Life. There's a true sense of exploration and curiosity when it comes to reincarnation. Dr. Tucker and I dive into some of the fascinating stories about children he's worked with over the years who share detailed, I'm talking about detailed, accounts of past lives that Dr. Tucker and his team are then able to research just like any other scientist in any other field and potentially validate. These experiences have opened up his mind to the amazing possibilities that our consciousness holds and how, when we die, the story itself may not be done. Let's listen in with my interview with Dr. Jim Tucker. Well, I'd love to start off with a story. And I was hoping if you might take one of the stories slash case studies that you featured inside of your book, which is excellent, by the way, and start us off from there.
Well, one well-known American case is a little boy named James Leininger, who around the time of his second birthday started having terrible nightmares multiple times a week, in which he would be kicking his legs up in the air and screaming, "Airplane crash on fire, little man can't get out." And then during the day, he would take his toy airplanes and repeatedly crash them into the coffee table, saying, "Airplane crash on fire." And with all this going on, he looked like a kid who had been traumatized, although he had not been through any sort of plane crash in this life. And there were several times where his parents could talk to him about these things while he was awake. And what he described was being a pilot who had been shot down by the Japanese. And he said that he flew off of a boat, and the parents asked him the name of the boat, and he said Natoma, which, you know, seems like an unusual name for a U.S. aircraft carrier. But his parents, who were quite opposed to the idea of past lives at the beginning, did an online search and discovered that there was this USS Natoma Bay that was stationed in the Pacific during World War II. And then later he said that he saw a picture of Iwo Jima and said that's where his plane had been shot down. They would also ask him what his name was, and he would always just say me or James, which they didn't make anything of at the time. And one time they asked him who else was there, and he said Jack Larson. Well, this went on, and he also described how his plane had crashed, how it had been hit in the engine, crashed in the water, and quickly sank. And eventually, with all this going on, his parents did begin to wonder, was he remembering a past life? So his father went to a Natoma Bay reunion when James was 4 and a half, and learned that, in fact, there was a Jack Larson who had been on the ship. And he visited this Jack Larson, discovered he was on the ship during the Iwo Jima operation. And he also learned that there was one and only one pilot from the ship who was killed during the Iwo Jima operation, a young man in Pennsylvania named James Houston. So we can then compare James's statements to Houston's life. And what we see is that it matched up perfectly. Houston was on the Natoma Bay. He did get shot down by the Japanese. His plane crash happened exactly as James described, getting hit in the engine, crashing in the water, quickly sinking. And the pilot of the plane next to his on the day that he was killed was Jack Larson. So this is one where the previous life was from decades before. There's no way that this little boy had any information about it, and yet he had incredibly specific details about this man's life that all fit. So it is very hard to come up with an ordinary explanation that would explain how James got both the information as well as the emotions connected with this experience.
Let's talk about the scientific methodology of how you approach these cases when people write in and contact you or you hear about them, and how you begin the process of validating to see if there is something that's there. Could you walk us through that?
Yeah. So it's, you know, this is not controlled laboratory research. So when you're looking at spontaneous events, it's not going to be as tightly controlled as other work might be. But it's certainly, we certainly take a scientific approach and try to control it as much as we can. So when we get a report, the one key is to document as much as possible the child's statements about a past life, preferably before anyone has identified a past life that, you know, people think might be, the child might be remembering. So In the two cases that I've described so far, there was great documentation of Ryan's cases because Ryan's statements, because you know we were the ones who determined who the past life was. There's also good documentation for James too. So we have that documentation, and then we try to see how well it fits with the past life. So that you know that means usually contacting the previous family and going over the details one by one to see how much of a fit there is. And again, we also look, could the child have learned these things through ordinary means? And if it's in the same family, you know, you can never be certain that they haven't overheard things, or even in the same town. When you've got ones that are hundreds of miles away and decades apart, you know, you can be a lot more confident about that. And then in some of the cases, we've also been able to do recognition tests where we show them pictures of a person or a place from the past life, along with a control picture that's not from the past life. And sometimes we'll do a lineup with several. But anyway, asking the child to point out, see if they remember any of them. And in a couple of recent cases, we've gotten quite impressive results with that. So that's something that's kind of more controlled and more quantifiable. So there's one child where with these picture tests we did, I did pairs of pictures because the children are so young. I learned if you show them four or five pictures at once, it just kind of overwhelms them. But I showed them pairs of pictures. And with the ones the child made a selection on, did he remember it from the past life, and, you know, versus a control picture? The child was 6 out of 6. And, you know, you can do the math on that. It's like flipping a coin 6 times, having it come up heads every time. It's extremely unlikely. It's statistically significant. So that, you know, we do that as well when we can. And, you know, then you just put this all together. And again, you recognize with setting the spontaneous event, there will be potential imperfections. But then you look at it and say, okay, what's the most plausible explanation for this? And is there a plausible explanation for how the child could have learned these things in an ordinary way? And again, for some of them, there does not appear to be.
There was a movie that came out, I don't know if you watched it, Disney movie Soul. And that sort of picked back up some of the interest in this topic for a lot of people who maybe weren't as familiar. And that specifically, you know, focused on especially this in-between place that in the story that the main protagonist was sort of in while they were thinking. And obviously, you know, this is a Disney movie, Pixar, Disney. It's a fictitious, you know, nice story, great story. But that begged the question for a lot of people with this topic is that do these young kids ever talk about sort of that in-between place that they're in?
Well, they do. 20% of the kids will talk about some sort of experiences between lives, after the death from the previous life and before the child is born. And there are different types that they will talk about. So some of them will talk about either staying near the previous family or staying near where the previous person died. And some of them will give details about observing the funeral for themselves, sometimes giving verifiable details. And so like there was one little girl in Thailand who made a lot of statements about the past life. But one thing was she complained that her ashes had been scattered rather than buried the way that she wanted them to be. Well, the previous woman had wanted her ashes buried at the Bo tree of the temple complex where she studied. But when her daughter went to buried them, the root system of the tree was so extensive that she couldn't. So she scattered them instead. So there can be kind of verifiable details like that. Other kids will talk about going to another realm like heaven. The American kids may use the word heaven. And, you know, to be honest, some of those reports sound kind of fantastical. And of course, they're coming through the mind of a 3 or 4 year old. But, you know, they will talk about a heavenly type city. Some of them will talk about either seeing other entities, spirits or guides, or some of them will talk about seeing God. And then some of them will talk about preparing for the next life of either observing their parents, during the pregnancy or before the pregnancy, or choosing them and then coming back and to be reborn. So James, for instance, one day told his father how he had chosen his parents and said that he had seen them eating on the beach at a pink hotel when he decided he wanted to be born to them. And actually, I think I have this story straight. I think he even said Hawaii, where there was a big pink hotel. And it turned out that his parents had been to Hawaii, had stayed at a big pink hotel on the last night they had, in fact, eaten on the beach. And they took that trip as they were preparing to try to get pregnant. So they didn't actually get pregnant for a couple of months, but that was when the intention began. And needless to say, his father is flabbergasted that James described that event in such detail. So there can be verifiable details that the children give about the time before they are either before conception or before they're born.
Our culture has tended to view dying as the end of our consciousness, the end of our existence, a dreaded prospect that for many invokes fear and anxiety. But Dr. Grayson and Dr. Tucker both show us how scientific revelations about the dying process and the time in between dying and rebirth can support an alternate theory. Dying could be a threshold between one form of consciousness and another, not an end, but a transition. This new perspective on the nature of death can transform the fear of dying that pervades our culture into a healthy view of one that is more about a milestone in the course of our lives. These conversations challenge us to open our minds to these experiences and to what they can possibly teach us. And in doing so, expand our understanding of consciousness and what it means to truly be human. Thanks for tuning into this week's mini episode of the Drew Perrott Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, do me a favor, share it with a friend who you think this podcast might resonate with. Who knows? You just might make their day. I'll see you next week.